The reading this morning is from the first book of Samuel, chapter 1, the birth of Samuel. There was a certain man from Ramathaim, a Zuphite from the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. He had two wives. One was called Hannah, and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. Year after year, this man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her, and the Lord had closed her womb. And because the Lord had closed her womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her till she wept and would not eat. Elkanah, her husband, would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you so downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? Once, when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on a chair by the doorpost of the Lord's temple. In bitterness of soul, Hannah wept much and prayed to the Lord. And she made a vow, saying, 'O Lord Almighty, if you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head.'" As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk and said to her, "How long will you keep on getting drunk? Get rid of your wine." "Not so, my lord," Hannah replied. "I'm a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief." Eli answered, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him." She said, "May your servant find favor in your eyes." Then she went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. Early the next morning they arose and worshipped before the Lord, and then went back to their home in Ramah. Elkanah lay with Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So in the course of time, Hannah conceived and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, "Because I asked the Lord for him." Thanks be to God.
Well, I think that at least this evening I should be greeting you all by saying, Shana Tova. Well, thank you very much. That would be just about right, actually, Kerrigan, now you mention it. Because, of course, as you all know, today is the first, or will be at sundown, the first day of Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year. And so what I was wishing you, in Hebrew, was Happy New Year. Have a good year. Or, as they say, have a good and a sweet year. It's interesting that this will go on from tonight until Tuesday, and the celebration, and guess what one of the readings that they will all be gathered around the Old Testament to hear is? Yes, got it in 1 Samuel chapter 1, what we've just heard. That is one of the passages that they will be all listening to during the New Year celebrations. So, this is the starting point of our new morning series, The Life of Samuel. And, of course, Hannah, as you all know, means grace. Hannah means grace. So, she had a lovely name, didn't she? We need a backdrop to set this story against. Joshua, who'd led the nation of Israel into the Promised Land, died at the age of 110, chapter 24 of Joshua. And before long, the Israelites, unfortunately, were busy disobeying God's express command not to intermarry with the locals, who they should have driven out. This resulted in the Israelites serving the foreign gods of their new wives, and not God. Then there followed a cycle of oppression by one of the nations round about, causing Israel to cry out to the Lord for help, who duly would reply to them by lifting up, raising up a person, a leader, to take them, to rescue them from their enemies. And this person was called a judge, because not only were they a leader, they actually solved disputes and this sort of thing at this time. And so the Spirit of the Lord was always upon this judge person. And the book of Judges, which comes on after Joshua, covers this repeated cycle through the lives of 12 judges. Some of whom you will recognize, of course. You will know the name Gideon, you'll know the name Deborah, you'll know the name Samson. And some of them which will probably not ring any bells at all. Ehud? No. Shamgar? No. Abdon? No. Well, there you are. That proves it. Some we know, some we don't know. At the end of the book of Judges, we have this rather damning comment on the people of Israel. It says, "In those days, Israel had no king, and all the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes." No, we're not discussing Great Britain in 2019, particularly Parliament. Anyway, against this immoral, disorderly, and generally godless backdrop, we come across one family who's bucking the trend. And that was the family we heard about from Audrey's reading this morning. We were introduced to a lady who had a problem. Hannah's difficulty. What was this problem? Well, let's just think a bit about her family. Her husband, Elkanah, or Elkanah, you say one, I say the other, don't know which it is. That means, by the way, God has created. That's what his name means. He lived in Ramah. Ooh, I've got to do something clever. Yeah, there's a map. You'll probably recognise that. See the Philistines down the left? They're one of the nations that caused a problem to Israel. Can you just about spot Bethlehem on the right hand side, up by the water, just there, and a bit difficult to see, but if you look at the top where there's an arrow pointing, it says Shiloh. That's going to figure. And if you get work down from Shiloh, you come to Ramah. It's got two arrows, one to the top left of it, one to the right of it, Ramah. And it's not that far really from Jerusalem, which isn't called Jerusalem at that point. It's called Jebus, I think, because it hasn't been captured. There we are, by that middle arrow, Jebus. That was Jerusalem. That was what it was called before it was actually taken and became the capital of Israel. Okay, so this is the land that we're talking about. And Ephraim, well, you remember that Israel was divided up into territories for the 12 tribes. Yeah, each tribe had a bit of land to look after. And Ephraim was where Ramah is, just north of Jerusalem. So that's and it's got some hills. That's why it was called the hill country of Ephraim. Okay, so that's where this family lived. And his ancestry, Elkanah's ancestry, if we look in Chronicles, we'll find he is actually a Levite. So he's not an Ephraimite. He was a Levite. But the Levites used to help in the tabernacle. Now, the temple hadn't been built at this stage, and do you remember Moses was commanded by God to construct a portable temple called the tabernacle, or the tent of meeting, which they carried around with them in the wilderness, and when they got to Israel, they put it up eventually, first of all in Gilgal, but later on they moved it to Shiloh. So Shiloh was the sort of the Jerusalem, if I can call it that, of the day. That's where they used to go to worship God, in the tabernacle. And the Levites were sort of minor priests, and they did all sorts of things. They opened the doors, they shut the doors, they kept an eye on things, they did sort of menial tasks. They played music, well that's a menial task, and they stood guard, basically. That was what a Levite did. They were the descendants of Levi, one of the 12 tribes. The priests, of course, were the high priests and the priests were ancestors. No, they weren't. They were descendants. Get the right way around. Descendants of Aaron. They were the big wigs. So, and also, the Levites were responsible in the wilderness for packing up the tabernacle and unpacking it each time they stopped somewhere and putting it up so it could be used again. Now, it would appear from the order of the wives, Hannah was the first wife of Elkanah, and the problem was she didn't seem to be able to have any children, and the Levites needed reproducing because you could have lots of Levites to look after the tabernacle. So what did he do? Not really a good thing. He got himself another wife called Peninnah, which means pearl. So he got himself a pearl of a wife, and in fact what she did was she produced for him lots of children, loads, boys and girls. So she did her job, but unfortunately, not only was Hannah barren, apparently, she was also being belittled by Peninnah. Peninnah had one of those, and she took every opportunity to downgrade Hannah, his first wife, and her position, because she had no children. It was a real stigma in those days not to have children, and she just added fuel to the fire, unfortunately. Very unpleasant lady. And the worst time was when they went up to Shiloh, up there, to go to the temple, as it was called, although it wasn't really. Oh, I've gone too far. Let's go back again. There we are. No, no. I don't want to go there. Can you get me back to picture that one? That's the one, thank you, yes. That is, see the children over there? There's Peninnah giving her the eye, you know. You haven't got children to look after. Mind you, in some cases you might think that's a good thing, but that's not the point. So they went up about 15 miles to get to Shiloh from Ramah, and that was a day's journey. And that was the time when Peninnah was particularly vicious. I suppose they were all together as a family group going up to the temple, and she was horrible. Really, really horrible. Elkanah used to go up once a year with a thank offering. And this thank offering, it was not like a sin offering. What happened with a thank offering was you made this sacrifice, or the priest had to do it for you. You weren't allowed to touch it. So you took your animal, and it was sacrificed and roasted, and the priests were allowed to take certain portions, and all the rest was over to you. And so you had your feast, and you had your food ready, you see. So this is what used to happen. And, of course, Peninnah and her children each had their lovely portion of meat. And because Elkanah really did love her, he gave Hannah a double portion. There was one snag. Because of all the taunting and the backbiting and the horrible, nasty things that Peninnah used to say to her, didn't feel like eating. She just did not feel like eating. In fact, she felt like crying. That was all. And so she was barren, she was belittled, and she was absolutely broken, was Hannah. Reduced to tears every time they went up. And her husband, although he genuinely loved her, he was a male, wasn't he? Did he help? No. What did he say to her? His words of comfort were so helpful. You have me! Isn't that better than having 10 sons? No, it wasn't, Elkanah, is the answer to that question. I do not think so. This is not the problem. So this only made matters worse for poor old Hannah, who would just lose her focus as they were going to worship God. It was so hard for her. And this happened year after year after year. So, we have Hannah's difficulty, but then we see a little bit about Hannah's determination. This year was different. After the meal, she managed at last to get up and take herself off to the tabernacle on her own. And when she got there, she prayed. And what a prayer! Came from the heart, pouring out. Like, in fact, many of David's Psalms, when he tells it as it is. He's desperate. He tells God he's desperate. He doesn't say, well, actually, I'm quite well, thank you very much, God. But, you know, just one or two little problems. He pours it out. He really does. And so, oh, that's it. Thank you very much, John. There she is, pouring out her heart. Really, really, you know, from inside, welling up. And she says it as it is. Anguish, tears, frustration, grief, hurt, it all comes out in her prayer. She doesn't actually say it aloud. She just says, but her, you know, she's, her lips are moving, but it's all inside. And of course, not only does she come out with this fervent prayer, she also makes a faithful promise. She is aware of God's power. She addresses him as the Lord of hosts. So I don't know whether you noticed that. It's the first time in the Old Testament that phrase is used. The Lord of hosts. The Lord of heaven's armies. Or in the Hebrew, Lord God of Sabaoth. Sabaoth is the bit that means heaven's hosts. This God could perform miracles. Now she knew stories. She might not have had them written down, but she knew about the patriarchs and their wives. You know, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. They'd each had a wife, Sarah, Rebecca and Rachel, who couldn't seem to conceive. And each time they prayed. And the God had answered their prayers. And each of them had given a son. Eventually. God was the God of miracles. If God had helped these patriarchs' wives, surely he could help her, she was probably thinking. And so she makes a vow to God and promises to give her son back to God should he answer her prayer. And she makes a Nazarite vow. No haircut. Well, I suppose that saved a bit of money. Also, no alcohol, but it doesn't say that there. This was a Nazarite vow. It was a vow which people used to do to commit themselves to God for a short period of time. But here, she is committing her baby, if she has one, for his whole life to do this. You'll remember Samson was similar. His mum, whose name we don't know, his dad was Manoah, she couldn't have children. And when she did have a child, she named him Samson, and she took a vow that he shouldn't shave his hair as well. And you know all the stories that came from that. Normally it was a short-term vow, but here it's forever. What a sacrifice. She was actually saying, I'm going to give my son, who I've longed for and dearly want, back to you, to thank you. So, her fervent prayer contained a faithful promise, and her presence, in God's presence, was totally focused on him. No vocalizing, just inside her head, but with obvious lip movement, face contortions and gestures. Enter another figure in the story. Ta-da! Eli, the priest. Now, as you can see there, he was getting on a bit, and he's a bit infirm. And can you see the two youngsters? Those are his sons, who were mentioned, Hophni and Phinehas. They were bad news, but we'll hear about them later in another morning service. But he kept an eye on the people who were visiting the tabernacle. He sat in his chair just outside the entrance, did Eli. And as he looked in, he could see Hannah was praying. Praying silently. And all these movements and contortions. And as you would if you were a priest in those days, you just assumed she was drinking. Well, that actually does say something about the religious situation, doesn't it? That he was used to seeing ladies, stroke men, who'd had too much beer, too much wine, and were just, you know, in a merry state. And so he assumed that this was what she was doing. Hannah soon puts him right. She says quite curtly, directly and succinctly that that's not what she's doing and she's not that type of person. To his credit, Eli does respond favourably. He doesn't know why she's in this state, but he blesses her with a helpful prayer that God will grant her request. And this blessing gives her a huge lift. Physically, she can eat again, and emotionally, she can cope with life again. Her face changes. I wonder what Peninnah thought. Don't know. So, we end up this story with Hannah's delight. We've had her difficulty, her determination, and now her delight. The family returns home the next day. Wonder how the conversation went with Peninnah on the journey. It takes a while, but eventually, she does conceive. Well, she wasn't really barren. It was all for God's purposes. He had closed her womb, and now was the right time for the womb to be opened so that the product, the son that she was going to have, would bless not only the family, not only people round about, but the whole nation. That's what was going to happen. That was God's plan. And she displays her understanding of this by naming God's gift to her, Samuel, which means something like asked of God or heard by God. That's what his name means. For her, it was sheer delight. Her prayer had been answered. God had intervened. And she displayed her readiness to keep her promise to God, who certainly displayed his great love to her. Okay, so well and good. So what's in this real life story for us, you may well be asking. What can we learn from it? Well, undeniably, Hannah was facing up to a personal difficulty that she could neither understand nor cope with. It caused her problems in relationships with others and affected her own relationship with God. But it was solvable, provided she could control herself long enough, just long enough to come face to face with God in prayer. It was a struggle. It took years. It took a long time, perhaps far too long. But when she got there and poured everything out to God, it was not only a huge relief for her, but she was also aware that he could and would do something about her difficulty, as the semi-ignorant Eli had confirmed with his blessing. And it changed her radically, physically, emotionally and spiritually. Well, I could ask the question today, who amongst us here hasn't had to face an intensely difficult personal problem? Could have been about work, about our family, our spouse, an illness, hospital, relationships, crucial choices, unexpected events, unforeseen crises, and the list could go on. What do we do about it, though, whatever that problem is? Do we try to sort it out ourselves? Do we seek advice from a friend? Do we take steps ourselves that could improve matters? None of these are bad or wrong, but should they be step one in trying to solve our problem? Should it not be prayer that constitutes the first step, and then perhaps other things as God prompts us thereafter? So often in our lives, in my life, prayer is a backstop to use when all else fails. Nor should it just be a 20-second long prayer that we can easily roll off the tongue. Hannah's prayer, carried out when she was on her own, was lengthy and costly. She literally gave her all, poured out everything, flushed out every little thought that had been nagging in her mind. Just think a minute of other biblical examples. Think of Jesus and his prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he was facing up to a hideous death on the cross. His anguished prayer is recorded in Matthew 26 and Mark 14, but it's only in Luke's Gospel, Dr. Luke, who adds the detail that Jesus was in such agony of spirit that his sweat fell to the ground like great drops of blood. What effort, an intense effort, Jesus put into that prayer. It was when Hannah had prayed in a similar manner and also recognised who she was dealing with, the Lord of heaven's armies, that everything fell into place. We only have a restricted view of our problem, but God sees it all, the end from the beginning, as Isaiah put it. He knows what we want, but more important, he knows what we need. His answer may not be what we hope for or even expect. Hannah was lucky in that respect, but he does know what's best for us. This week, if you or I have to face up to either a long-standing problem or a brand new one, let's take it to God without delay and tell him exactly how we feel about it. Let's let our British stiff upper lip loosen. Let's also recognise that he alone is able to cause what really is best for us to come to pass. And we can also support our brothers and sisters in a similar way by sharing their struggles. As Paul puts it, I urge you in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ to join in my struggle by praying to God for me. One thing is sure, based on this life story from God's own word, he will not disappoint us, as Paul puts it in Ephesians. Now all glory to God, who is able, through his mighty power at work within us, to accomplish infinitely more than we might ask or imagine.